Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in today. On the show, we've got Patrick Hebert. Patrick is the co-founder and CEO of Eco Villages. They make sustainable living villages and communities with a libertarian-oriented mindset all over Central America. They're migrating to South America as well. This conversation absolutely blew me away. I'm honestly reluctant to even share this episode because I don't want anyone taking the plot of land that I would like to get in one of these villages. But I think you're going to love it. I know I sure did. Hope you enjoy the episode. Alrighty, like I said in the intro, I've got Patrick here with me today. Patrick, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. You guys are doing some really cool stuff. I'd love to just jump right into the good stuff here. Why don't you just sort of frame out for listeners what Eco Villages is, what makes the concept so special, and then we'll get into the backstory behind it a bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, to start with, we kind of have an umbrella of companies, but Eco Villages is under Autris, and it's actually a publicly traded company as of a few days ago, I guess, AUTR on the OTC market. We want to kind of share the ability of others to ride along with us as we create our communities. But basically what we're doing is creating what we call Veritas Villages, and they're freedom-oriented, sustainability-oriented communities, and currently within different countries in Latin America. I'm sitting here at our Veritas Village Coronado community in Panama, the country of Panama. And we basically build our communities based on what we've created, a philosophy called our FIRST philosophy, F-I-R-S-T, and it stands for freedom, independence, resiliency, sustainability, and transparency. And it's a lot of words, but you can kind of get the idea that, what that's all about. We really believe in, a strong level of freedom. It's been an evolution of creating these communities for the last couple of decades. But, when COVID hit is when things really, really cemented the concept of freedom and self-sustainability for us. And, we admittedly kind of a libertarian style group, like-minded people like to live in these communities. We don't sit and talk about politics all day, but realistically we don't like control, we don't like big authoritarian governments, we don't like big taxes, we don't like that sort of thing. So if that fits with what people like, then they'll love living in one of these communities or having a plan B in one of these communities. And on the freedom side, there's lots of forms of freedom. There's obviously freedom of speech. All of us can't stand censorship and cancel culture. But there's also financial freedom, which is probably why you and I are talking today when it comes to Bitcoin versus, printing money in fiat. And so that all our communities within Veritas Villages, all the commercial businesses within the communities have to accept Bitcoin as well as whatever other currency they want to accept.
That's amazing. I think a thread runs through all of these concepts, right? I think financial self-sovereignty is one piece of the puzzle. It's certainly something that we spend a lot of time thinking about at the Bitcoin Way, but freedom of movement and it's like you've established a citadel, for like-minded individuals. And if anyone's ever been to a Bitcoin conference or gone to Bitcoin meetups, they know how fun it is to be surrounded by people who you have so many things in common with. And this seems like you've basically turned it into a lifestyle. So let's take a step back. Why don't you talk a bit about what led you to this point, your background, the inspiration behind building this? Maybe you could talk a little bit more about what COVID did to sort of shift your mindset as well.
Yeah. So if we go back 20 or 30 years, I was in the software business. I created software companies for energy management, oil and gas and that sort of thing, and electricity. Did well enough, grew those companies to a few hundred people, and was able to sell them and be acquired. And then my son, who was young at the time, he now works with me as a co-founder of Autris here, but we lived on a boat and sailed around in the Vancouver Island, Seattle, Puget Sound, and Gulf Islands area up there. For anybody that's into sailing, it's a beautiful spot. And we'd really, it became a bit of a game, to be honest. At that time, we didn't really think about it, as where it would end up. But we loved the self-sustainability, right? When you're in a sailboat on the ocean, you don't get to have a long extension cord. So you're creating your own power. You're desalinating the ocean salt water into potable water. you know, all those sorts of things that make you sustainable, and you're catching fish and eating sea asparagus and different things that you find out in the ocean to survive. Now, we always had our can of pork and beans and things like that to as a backup plan when we weren't doing so well on catching our own food. But that's really where it came from. And then, you know, one day I just kind of, we were lucky enough to travel a lot, came down to Latin America, really surprisingly ended up loving Nicaragua, you know, initially, couple countries north of where I'm in Panama right now. And, you know, decided, well, why don't we move this self-sustainable kind of lifestyle to making off-grid communities, luxury communities. So people think of off-grid sometimes, and it's why we kind of are getting away from the name eco-villages a little bit and more using our formal name of Autris. Because people think of, you know, eco-villages as you got to live in some dilapidated cabin out in the woods or something like that. And these are not that. These are luxury homes just on a self-sustainable, you know, independent, resilient type of community. So we did that. We created some beautiful homes in a small community in Nicaragua a couple decades ago. It was completely off-grid. And nowadays, the systems are just, the technology is so much better, the battery power and everything. Like, it's so much easier, frankly, to do 20 years later than it was back then. But it's amazing. Like, I'm sitting here in our welcome center in the community. This is a heritage building. It's a little different. It was built by all the materials, the rock and timber that was milled on site and all those sorts of things. But, you know, this entire community doesn't have any utility power coming into it, doesn't have the municipal water coming into it, doesn't have, we have everything. You know, we have, you know, water, our own water wells, our own community orchards and gardens, food forest, hydroponic plants, tilapia pond, stream that comes through it. So all food and water is covered. And then each home has its own solar system. And of course, we're near the equator here, so we get tons of solar power. And we're just actually upgrading our, I've got all the equipment out, and later today I'm going to be putting in our new Bitcoin miner, which is, as far as I know, probably one of the few ones here in Latin America that are run 100% off solar power. So, you know, pretty cool stuff that we're able to do with the excess power here. And so it's been an evolution of going from, you know, living on a boat, getting the ideas of how to become self-sufficient. And I love the freedom of it, right? There, you know, no government telling me what to do out on the ocean. And, you know, and so that we just applied that here. And the culture in Latin America is very much a live and let live culture. So this was the right place to do it, right? It's a gated community. We're very, you know, in touch with the local people around us. And we have, you know, farm trading and stuff going on between the locals in here and, you know, all sorts of things. But if the next COVID hits the fan, we can just shut the gate and say, now, you know, we don't feel like wearing masks in here. We're not forcing vaccinations. We're not doing a lockdown. We're just basically living life normally. And that was why COVID really, you know, we'd always been doing these kind of sort of self-sufficient communities, but that's really where we came up with the first certification or first philosophy and said, this is going to be a little bit more hardcore now for like-minded people.
So I'm curious, it sounds like you had a lot of boxes to check in terms of the land and the space that would meet your criteria for, you know, you had a very specific vision for this. What was the process of finding that? What were some of the things in particular you were looking for? Was it a long process? Is it, you know, is it difficult when you go out, you set forth to build a brand new community that needs to be self-sustainable and have this, you know, certain culture around it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I looked at probably just under 50 different properties to find the one I'm sitting in right now. And it's really, you know, there's a few pages of check boxes to check. I mean, and it's changed over time, right? It used to be we needed 3-phase power to run to the site, but now we don't care about that anymore. In fact, we don't even want it. We want to be independent with our own power. But for instance, here in the tropics here, if you're living down by the beach, which a lot of people love to do, it's very hot and you get a lot of salt spray, for instance, from the ocean. So it's difficult to grow things. So in a community that we want to be fully independent, where we can grow anything, we've just planted in the orchard another 40 or 50 varieties of fruit that I don't even know what they are, but I'm looking forward to trying. There are lots of different rare things. Excuse me. And so we're at about 300 meters of elevation here, so roughly 1,000 feet of elevation. That gets us right into the sweet spot for us. You know, it's not right at ocean level, even though I'm looking out at the ocean here. And it's only a few minutes away to some of the most beautiful beaches. But we live in this area where it's quieter. It's further, you know, it's near a town, but it's not in town. It's at an elevation where everything grows. It's amazing what we can grow. Everything from coffee to bananas and papayas and, you know, the carrots and potatoes and everything else you need to grow. But just being that, it's also comfortable for people, right? It's about 5 degrees roughly Celsius, maybe 9 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than down by the beach. So you get what they refer to it as springtime all the time. It's always, you know, in that beautiful kind of weather pattern. We're not so high up in the mountains where we're in the cloud forest where you get a lot of rain. So we just, it takes a lot of effort to find this sweet spot. And this we found is a beautiful plateau with amazing views, which is pretty rare in this area too. So I'm actually on the hunt next week in Costa Rica and Mexico and Argentina, where we're expanding into next. And, you know, I got that long list of checkboxes to go through again. So it's not easy. It takes time to find the exact property that works, but it's rewarding when we find it.
Oh, if your background is any indication of how you've done, I mean, that's proof of work. I love to see it. So, hey, you talked about like an orchard. Can you, I think there are sort of two things I'm curious about. First, I suspect a lot of people don't, you know, just our modern society has drained us of many skills known to our ancestors, growing our own food and some of the sustainability. Is that something that people might need to be intimidated by, or the skills required, you know, to live this sort of lifestyle, you know, relatively accessible? And two, how does that work? So like who manages the orchard? Is it just a group effort? What's the expectation? Any sort of detail on that would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not something to be intimidated by. In fact, that's what makes the community part versus just doing this yourself and moving out into a farm in the wilderness is the community. First of all, you're surrounded by like-minded people, so it's fun. You get to have a good time and you have to have a community. But it's also, you know, we have sort of a two-tier way of taking care of orchards and gardens. First of all, we hire locals, so there's like full-time people dealing with that. We've tried various methods in the past, and you know, some people say they love gardening and that's great, but then it gets tiring after a while and they don't feel like that's, you know, why should I be doing all the work to feed everybody in the community? So it's best if the HOA hires people to do that, and they're locals and they know it, like they're the permaculture experts for this area. You know, we've had people come down from Canada that are permaculture experts there, but they know nothing about what grows here and what the soil type is like here and all those sorts of things. So you definitely need the locals involved. And that's, you know, it's another good part of the community. We're providing jobs in all sorts of different ways for the local economy here too. But then we generally have kind of annually we elect, or, you know, somebody decides they'd like to be the what we call the champion. And they're just people that love orchards and gardens and they just want to be part of it. And they're part of the community and they kind of help make sure that, you know, so basically what, you know, on a detailed level, what often happens is on a Tuesday morning or Tuesdays and Saturdays, for instance, the local guys that are working in the orchards and gardens will create, you know, a bag of different things, of potatoes and whatever, lettuce and different things, and, you know, or bananas, whatever's in season at that time, and just create kind of little variety packs, and people can come by on those mornings and just pick up the fruits and vegetables and meat, you know, from, we have the stables as well for livestock. And so basically, you know, eating is virtually free if you want it to be, right? You can also, the properties here, the individual lots are quite large, you know, probably a fifth of an acre and up to 2 acres. So you can grow a lot of your own stuff if you're into that too, but you don't have to. You can just, you know, rely on the community to do it. And that's what we build the communities for. So it functions well. And, you know, it's our goal here, and that's, you know, the Bitcoin miner I mentioned is kind of the final step. So if you have your water for free, you have your food for free, you basically paid for your home, and now you don't have really a lot of, you know, lifestyle expenses, cost of living going forwards. The only thing is, obviously, there's an HOA fee, and we make them very reasonable, and that HOA decides itself. Us as the developers don't make those decisions. And I'll talk a little bit about the DAO of how we use it to make decisions. But if you can offset the HOA fee and your property tax, unfortunately, we can't get around country's property tax, so we have to still pay that. But if you can pay for those two things, even with, you know, the funds from your Bitcoin miner that's using excess power on your solar system, then you really get as close to zero, almost, the cost of living as possible. And that's kind of one of the goals, to live in a luxury, you know, like-minded community with almost no costs.
Man, you're blowing my mind right now. This is unbelievable. So I'm curious, as someone whose interest is seriously peaked in this, what are like the typical clients for you? If you want to get into sort of costs you might expect, you know, from property to, you know, ongoing living expenses, that'd be great. But if not, I certainly understand people can reach out. Are these retirees? Are they generally wealthier families, folks looking for a second home? Can you rent out your place when you're not there? What are the sort of options that you have?
Yeah. So, you know, before COVID, I would say the typical resident was somebody maybe either retiree or somebody, let's say, in their 40s that says, you know, I would like to have my tropical home. I'm going to rent it out for the next 10 or 20 years, and then I'm going to move into it when I retire. That was a pretty typical customer for us. When COVID hit, if there was a silver lining to that, it taught pretty much everybody around the world that, you know, a lot of people could work from home. And once they realized they could work from home, it's, well, I can have my home anywhere. I don't have to be in, you know, some suburb of Detroit or something. I'm not picking on Detroit, but I'm just saying that, you know, when you kind of open your mind to, well, I could live in the tropics, and, you know, we get all sorts of people, like architects or whatever, that can have their customers from somewhere else. And, you know, I'll go off on that in a little while too, but you can structure that so it's completely income tax free down here. So it's pretty cool. And yeah. So what was the second part of your question there? Sorry.
Was it renting out houses? Yeah, you said, yeah, that's sort of where it started. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, you can, I mean, most of the people that, you know, are buying in these communities are planning on living in them. But we also have communities in Belize, Honduras, Nicaragua, and we're expanding, like I said, to Mexico, Costa Rica, Argentina. So people will sometimes, you know, the cost of buying a home, and I explained that too. Yeah, that's what your question was. Sorry, I went on a tangent there. The cost of buying the homes are quite a bit lower here. So if you sold your home in, I don't know, California or something, then or Europe or anywhere in Canada these days, you know, you probably find that the homes here are maybe a third to a quarter of the price that they are up there for the equivalent home. So sometimes we get people that will buy one on our communities on the Caribbean side, one on the Pacific side, one here in the Highlands, and then spend 4 months of the year in each one, kind of following the best weather patterns that each location has. And then they rent the other two, and that covers their cost of living too. So that's becoming a more popular thing. So between the kind of digital nomads that are able to do that, but we're finding now that since COVID, because of that, we've got couples and families of all ages. We've got people in their 20s, their 30s, young children, babies, and teenage kids. You know, so it's a complete mix. In fact, the other day I was here for a couple weeks ago, and we had 10 different couples in a row that were coming to see and ultimately buy. We usually bat right around 1,000 when people see the place. It's beautiful, so they want to live here. But there was from 10 different countries in a row. It was like Italy, Germany, Netherlands, UK, Ireland, Canada, US, New Zealand, Australia. I probably missed one or two in there. But anyway, it's just like very like-minded people from around the world that are all kind of, you know, love the freedom aspect and the self-sustainability aspect, but aren't all coming from one spot in the world. So it's pretty cool. It makes it, you know, fun to sit at the Welcome Center here or, you know, hang out in the pool and have a drink, watch a sunset, and, you know, talk to people. Your neighbors are here from all over the world.
How many, what would you say the residents who are there as a primary residence most of the year, they're hanging out in their eco village? Is that like, you know, 80% now or still less?
Yeah,
than
I would
that?
Say it depends. Like we have some beachfront communities as well, which they're a little bit more transient, I guess. People buy them for both renting and for living in, or they're snowbirds, right? They're coming from up north and come down here during their winter, like this time of year. But in Veritas Village, Coronado, that I'm in, I mean, we're just getting the first homes being built now. But I suspect you're probably right, around 80 to 85% of people that will be considering this kind of their plan A. This is their home. And then they'll have other plan Bs and if they want, but you know, the others will, there's also that group of people that are buying this as a plan B. So if, you know, if the US keeps printing money at this speed and the debt gets ridiculous and, you know, you get have mostly peaceful protests breaking out, you know, then they can go somewhere. So the cost, like, I mean, you can, you know, for under $200,000, you can start here. Obviously the sky's the limit. We have people building multi-million dollar mansions here as well. So you can be all over the map. But what I love about it is it doesn't matter if you've got a tiny home on a small lot and that's, you know, that's all you really need in these climates. When you have that springtime all the time weather, you're hardly ever indoors. You go inside to sleep and even your kitchen is typically outdoors. So, you know, the homes can be a lot smaller, a lot less expensive, and they're still awesome. You have a great, you know, lot to hang out with, and you've got all the amenities, and, you know, we've got music studios, woodworking shops, and little commercial areas, farmers markets, and amphitheater, and all hiking trails, and all sorts of different things going on here. Swimming pools, obviously, tennis courts. And so there's lots of stuff to do, too. And you don't really need to have a big home to have, like, there's nobody that has great rooms and things that, you know, rooms that just never get used. But it's quite affordable, you know. So if you're selling your home in the U.S. for $750,000 and you come down here and buy one for 200, you've still got a lot of money that you can live off of. And if your cost of living goes down to nearly zero, you know, it's pretty easy to make that stretch.
Could you give a sense as to the scale of these communities? How big are they? How many lots are available? Like the one in Panama, for example, that you're at right now, what does that look like? I mean, is there a lot of availability? Is it becoming pretty scarce?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're pretty popular. I mean, it's a good problem for us to have. We wish we had a whole bunch more of these communities and inventory than we do. But the one I'm in here now is small by the standards that we'd like to have them. But this is about roughly 100 home sites. People build more than one home often. You know, the beauty of Latin America is they don't have the same restrictions that North America, Europe, Australia have, where you can kind of build as many homes as you want on your own property as long as it's reasonable. And, you know, that's just the beauty of the kind of live and let live aspect down here. They don't see that. There's not so many regulations. And so, you know, there'll be over 100 homes in this community when it's done. And we're trying to expand it as well. You know, for us, around 300 homes, like, basically creates a small town. And, you know, there's a break even sort of point where you have enough homes, enough people in the community to sort of justify the amenities that you're putting in, right? If you have 20 homes, it doesn't really justify having music studios and things like that, right? So, but if you have a few hundred, then it does. And the nice thing about these Veritas villages is it's basically that we have a Veritas village club. So as we create the new communities, you have the right as a resident owner in any one of the communities to visit and stay in the other ones at a discount and discounts at the restaurant. We have a beautiful restaurant that'll be coming up here soon with 360 degrees of the ocean and mountains that we're surrounded by. And so, you know, if you like, we're going to be creating Veritas Village, likely near Mendoza, Argentina, which will be in a vineyard. So if you want to make your own wine and you realize what it costs to be in some of the vineyard communities in Napa Valley, for instance, this will be a fraction of the cost of that. But you have the beauty of being in the wine country of Argentina. So plus, you know, so you could live there or live here and go there, and, you know, all, it just becomes a, you know, and you know, you're going to a community of like-minded Bitcoin using people. Right? So it's pretty cool.
I love it. So I guess you keep on saying things that just prompt lots of new questions. I'll ask my first selfish one for you is I've got three young kids. I'm curious what sort of, you know, if my family were to do something like this, what is there? That sounds like a swimming pool, which would be an absolute smash for my kids. But what sort of things do you have to keep kids occupied? Or does it tend to be an older crowd and maybe a little bit slower, or just a big mix?
No, it's a big mix. I mean, it's funny because we had a couple here the other day that was older and they were saying, we're kind of looking for a retirement community. I said, oh, this is probably not it. But at the same time, this German couple came in with a couple toddlers. And they were kind of grabbing on the older couple and saying, oh, grandpa, grandma, you're my new grandpa and grandma from Panama. And by the end of it, the older couple said, oh, I want to live in this community. I've forgotten how much I enjoy being around kids, right? So totally changed their mind, which I found was interesting. But yeah, we have multiple pools and, you know, playground and, you know, we have a tilapia pond. Kids can even go fishing in the stream. To me, it was like growing up when I was a kid in the prairies of Canada. You know, you went down to the creek and you caught fish and you did all this sort of stuff. And the thing I'm excited about, we have it's called an expat money school, but basically it's a friend of ours that runs schools online for kind of libertarian and, you know, an option to homeschooling. So there's actually basically a school that isn't woke, put it that way, right? And so a lot of people are excited about that because this will be the first brick and mortar school for this group. And you can go on our website and find out more about it. And you know, I'm excited about that because to me, it'll be like I remember going to school where, you know, the field trips were just kind of in your backyard because there was so much stuff, just, you know, nature around you. And, you know, we have got a zillion trees in here. Like, you know, we have a 250-year-old mango tree on the property. It's the oldest mango tree that I know of. And I always think, what was going on here in 250 years ago in this property? But so, yeah, it's definitely family oriented. And we're really looking forward to having that. And it adds a lot of vibrancy to the community, too.
Well, logistical question for you. How do you think about proximity to like airports and, you know, international airports in particular for accessibility? Is that, imagine if that's something that you're trying to achieve, it limits, you know, where you're going to find land and what you have to, again, check all those boxes. Are your communities generally pretty accessible for people flying in from out of the country?
Yeah, one of the check boxes is definitely to try to be within an hour, if possible, of an international airport. Here, we're just over a little hour, about an hour from Panama City, which is a main hub down here. It's a hub for all of Latin America. So you can, like, I just flew to Madrid and back the other day direct, right? So you can go all over the world from here. We also have what's known as the Rio Hato Airport. It's kind of a smaller airport, but it's only 20 minutes away. And it's actually an international airport as well. They have direct flights actually from Canada to right into, you know, kind of our backyard here. So it's, you know, pretty cool, but that is definitely one of the checkboxes. You know, a lot of communities will be 3-4 hours away from an airport. Doesn't really work well for us because a lot of the people that, including myself, like I'm going to have a home here in the community and I have to travel a lot. I have to go visit our other communities. I have to go check out land and different things all the time. So I can't be hours and hours away from a major hub airport. So, you know, as we look in San Jose area in Costa Rica, it'll be kind of a diameter around the city. We have a very secluded feeling here, but we're not that far away from anything. We're 15 minutes away from beaches. We're 10 minutes away from multiple grocery stores, hardware stores, shopping malls, movie theaters and stuff like that. And then we're, and less than an hour to one of the airports, but to the hub airport, about an hour, hour and a half, maybe, depending on the traffic. But that's, to me, that kind of puts us in the reasonableness spot. Like you want to get away from the hub of the city, but you want to be accessible to the transportation as well.
Yeah. Do most people have, like the people who stay there as their primary residence, do they have cars or are they just calling Ubers or what's sort of the mode of transportation if they want to go into the city?
It's a mix. I mean, countries like Panama here are really fun to explore. It's you know, as a Canadian, the distance between the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean takes about 14 days to drive. Right? So here it takes 35 minutes. We go to a beach on the Pacific in the morning and then we go to the Caribbean for lunch. Right. So it's pretty cool country that way. And it's got mountain ranges and everything. And, you know, so it's a lot of people have a car only just for exploring, but you can Uber anywhere and Uber is extremely inexpensive. It always shocks me when I have to go to Miami for something or whatever. Cost me $60 in Miami for the equivalent of $1.27 or something Uber down here. And, you know, there's cabs and buses and everything too. We actually have a solar powered shuttle bus here that will take people around the community or down to the local town for grocery shopping if they want to, or go to the movies and stuff like that. So, you know, again, as independent as possible. I get a kick out of being completely power independent. So even our vehicle, we shipped in from Asia and mounted solar panels on the top, and away we go. So it charges itself while we drive.
you guys haven't missed anything. So you talked earlier, you hinted at the sort of the governance structure of these communities, the DAO. Could you explain what a decentralized autonomous organization is, and like how does it work? And I guess one thing I'm curious about is there some, are there guardrails to that? Like, you know, because you've sort of set up this, you know, this community with a very specific intention, you know, they're freedom oriented folks. And, but you know, over time preferences can change. You might have some, you know, quote unquote, bad apples move into town, or, you know, what's the means by which changes or, you know, improvements to the community or anything like that happen?
Yeah, well, the DAO is really the central piece of that. And as far as I know, we're the only communities that use a DAO, a decentralized autonomous organization, for that purpose, right? For an HOA, a homeowners association. So typically what I've seen after a couple of decades of this with communities is developers either appoint or the community elects a HOA president. And that poor person has no ability to, you know, to make everybody happy all the time. So they're generally well hated, and it's just a losing battle for an HOA president. And anybody that's been in that role knows what I'm talking about. You hate going in to hang out with people because everybody's always wanting to complain about something. So what we decided, you know, if we have a mix of a kind of an advisory committee and using a blockchain, I've always been a blockchain fan since, you know, it came out, and just like Bitcoin's on a blockchain, a DAO is really used for voting for things on a blockchain. So you have all the security and the benefits of everything on a blockchain. It just, so what typically would happen is, let's say you come up with seven different things. Maybe there's a threshold, and you say, you can change the thresholds on different things, right? You can say it takes a 70% vote in order to pass, you know, or whatever, 81%. You can make whatever you want. It doesn't have to be 50-50. But then you say, okay, let's vote on, I can never think of great examples for this, but whether we want roosters in the community, right? Because roosters wake people up in the morning and it annoys them. So it's going to be like, well, do we want roosters or don't we? And that's going to be one of the, you know, maybe, like I said, you can set whatever criteria you want, but the set, when we get seven things to vote for, we go and we basically, you know, it's not that different than like a Survey Monkey or whatever type of survey where it's like, okay, I'm going to vote no, I don't want roosters. And if 70 people or 75 or 80 people or more vote that way, then they don't happen, right? So the community really controls that. And then there's nobody to blame, right? You can't say, oh, that HOA president, once again, he made a decision, not what the community wanted, it's what he wanted. And so this way, all you can do is really say, well, I guess the majority of the community, or even the super majority of the community, just doesn't want the same thing I want. And I'm going to have to live with that. And I think, you know, what I've found over the years is that the community is smarter than we give it credit for. Like, people think they need to elect or appoint a president, but they don't make as good decisions as the community does as a whole. So it really, you know, I'm looking for this one's this community here is going to really be the first one that uses a DAO entirely. We've done, you know, the kind of the survey type of thing before, but this one's, you know, going to have the benefits of it, you know, all the records basically being on a blockchain.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk a bit about Bitcoin. Explain to me sort of the integration of Bitcoin into the community. So basically any services being provided on the property have to accept Bitcoin. Is that part of the deal? And then I think it's Panama's, like, and I know it may vary by country, but Panama, I think, is on a US dollar standard. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Balboa is the currency here, pegged to 1-to-1 to the US dollar for many, many years now. Well, I was, you know, pretty involved with and you know, I'm good friends with Mike Peterson in El Salvador. So when Salvador Bukele, who I think is a rock star, basically adopted the Bitcoin as currency there, we were involved. We were designing a community, a Bitcoin oriented community. It hasn't been developed yet, but with Bitcoin museums and all sorts of things, like, you know, you could run on a treadmill and power a miner and stuff like that, different things that we were working on. And you know, I was really in awe of what Mike Peterson did there to kind of a grassroots effort in the Bitcoin Beach area, El Zante and in El Salvador. We are kind of replicating that in a small community in Nicaragua. We're trying to start from the ground up, much like these communities start from the ground up in terms of governance. And so we have accepted Bitcoin from the day we, you know, created the company. So we have a significant amount of our assets, our monetary assets in Bitcoin. We accept Bitcoin. Many people buy their homes on their home sites with Bitcoin. And then within the community, yes, if you have a beachware kiosk business, you got to accept Bitcoin. If you have a restaurant, you got to accept Bitcoin. That's one of the pieces that we don't make a lot of rules, but that's one of the financial freedom rules that we do make. And so, you know, we're big fans, and obviously today is a big day, right? We just hit new records today with Bitcoin. So, and I really think for, you know, this is a personal kind of feeling, but I really think for Bitcoin to become more adopted and orange pilling people, we really need to start using it more as a currency as much as an investment. I understand why people hodl and it's a great thing to do, but what I love about when I'm in El Salvador is I can just go out and buy a Big Mac at McDonald's and I can use sats to do it. And I do all the time. I love, you know, going to little remote villages in Salvador and using Bitcoin to buy lunch or buy a coffee or whatever it is. So I think the best way to make it, you know, more popular is to use it. So we're kind of enforcing that a little bit, I guess. Like I said, it's a freedom oriented community. You know, if you have a restaurant here or whatever the business is, or it, you know, it can accept US dollars or whatever currency they want, but one of them has to be Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. A lot of people get caught up in, like, I think what we're trying to escape is big government, people far removed from our daily lives, telling us what we can and can't do, how we have to build things, all of that. But I think at a community level, especially, you know, 100, 300 homes worth, I think it's prudent to make determinations about how we're going to operate together, you know. And that's why subdivision, I used to live in a subdivision and we had an HOA. And, you know, I think a DAO with like-minded people sounds a heck of a lot better. But the intent is really, you know, a thoughtful one. It's, hey, we've agreed to live in this neighborhood together. Let's make decisions that keep, you know, sort of put some checks and balances on what people can do. You can't put, you know, you can't build a giant castle in your backyard because it's going to be ugly and it's going to affect the home prices in the neighborhood, or, you know, just like, you know, silly things like that. So I think it makes a lot of sense to enforce some of these things because you're doing it at such a local level and people are opting into it. You're not imposing it upon them, you know, with like a sneaky provision that you put into the bylaws or something like that. Yeah. So
now we're very open about all this stuff. Obviously that's the transparency part of our first philosophy. And the Venn diagram overlap between Bitcoin purists and freedom lovers is pretty much 100% too. I think just about everybody in this community loves that idea. So it's we don't get any pushback on that.
Yeah. And the technology is getting easier and easier to integrate. So it's not like a big technical lift or something the way it might have been, you know, 10 years ago to ask people to accept Bitcoin. And I think that's great. Yeah. Anyone who's a true freedom lover has either adopted Bitcoin or maybe has talked themselves out of it for other reasons because they've been listening to Peter Schiff too long or something like that. But yeah, I think the average person, I think, yeah, the overlap is just undeniable. So I'm curious though, could you tell me a little bit about your Bitcoin origin story? Like, it sounds like you've kind of been a freedom lover for a long time. What actually led you down this path? I'm always interested in hearing, you know, where the rabbit hole began.
Yeah, well, I had an unfortunate start to Bitcoin because Bitcoin was 50 cents when I first found out about it. And I was living in Canada for that period of time. And I tried to, my brother-in-law actually called me and said, hey, you're a technical software guy. You should check out this Bitcoin thing. And that's how I heard about it. And it was early on in Bitcoin days. And then, so I went, okay, I'm going to buy, you know, 1,000 Bitcoin, $500 worth, right? And I couldn't get the bloody on-ramp wallet thing to work. And I've kicked myself since then, but I just went, I'll do it later. And later just became like 2016 or something. And it was just like, I mean, today that 1,000 Bitcoin would be worth over $100 million. So You know, what if $500 into $100 million mistake I've made? But you know, I have, you know, obviously you have so many stories out there. My brother-in-law used to play poker with Bitcoin, and he lost his wallet address. And he says, like, I don't know, I had hundreds of Bitcoin because we play poker every week betting with Bitcoin, and kind of like the pizza stories and stuff like that. And so that was not such a great start. I wish I could say, oh yeah, I bought when it was really low, and what, well, I still relatively low because of, like I said, 2016, I think, when I finally got my act together. But that's, you know, again, just a few years before COVID. And that was just part of that evolution of where we are today. You know, it wasn't like I woke up in 1998 and went, we're going to make first oriented, you know, communities, and it's all going to be perfect from day one. And it's been, you know, a lot of school of hard knocks learning along the way. But I think we're kind of getting over the hump now. We've learned an awful lot. It's not easy to do this sort of thing in Latin America either. It's a, you know, it's a slow motion area of the world, right? If you come from an impatient background, it's very tough. And a lot of developers come down here and fail because they just can't make the adjustment. So the barriers to entry for us is quite high of what we do. And then we're trying to always innovate. Like I said, solar powered miners and HOAs that are run by a DAO. And, you know, every time we think of good ways to solve something, I think we leapfrog our other developers around us. We get a lot of copycats, but people like you and I see through them pretty quickly too, right? They'll say, oh yeah, we're doing the UN 2030 approach here. And it's like, well, you clearly don't know what kind of person we are. Libertarians kind of get annoyed at that.
Oh yeah, yeah. Could you expand a bit on the challenges of development in Latin America? Like, what's difficult for the impatient person to you know, to grasp down there? Is it like the development process, the paperwork? Is it land acquisition? Like, what's difficult?
A lot of it is on the permitting side. It just takes a long time to get permits. That, you know, it's mostly just the culture, right? And I on one hand, everything is mañana, right? Everything, we'll get to it tomorrow. We'll get to it tomorrow. And from a personal lifestyle, that's great. Like, I came from the, you know, the rat race of software development, like the Silicon Valley style software development. And that was, you know, that'll drive you to have a heart attack. But this is the polar opposite of that. So from a personal standpoint, it's like, you know what, let's enjoy the day and let's, you know, have a beer in the pool and we'll think about what we're going to do tomorrow. But from a getting stuff done perspective, it can be a little frustrating. You know, your air conditioner is not working and you call the technician and he'll come next Tuesday or something. In the meantime, you've got a week of hot days, you know, and you have to just sort of kind of roll with it and get used to it. So there's the good and the bad. Obviously, from a business perspective, it can be a little frustrating when you're waiting a long time for stuff to get done, or, you know, construction and everything goes slower and everybody's, you know, just a lot more relaxed. And it, from that standpoint, it's great, but it's hard to get things done. My background is, I'm a Canadian, but with a German heritage. So my mind is more like a BMW assembly line. And this is the opposite of it down here. So everything is, and it's just, but it, once you're used to it, you can get used to it. But I always, you know, have so many different stories, but they're very regulated in some of the things and so unregulated in other things that you just got to kind of go through the school to figure out how it works.
It's probably a healthy sort of check on your life though. You know, I mean, so many of us, especially in the West, are so accustomed to instant gratification. It's like really lowering your time preference and, having, you know, the need for patience imposed on you seems like a great character building scenario in which to find yourself. So I think you could look at that as a downside, but it's probably in the grand scheme of things, maybe not such a, maybe it's something that we all need a little bit more of, right?
Yeah, no, so, I try to take it that way every day. Like, I'm, you know, this is good for me. If, you know, at 3 p.m. I call somebody, oh, we need to fix, you know, something on the car or whatever. It's like, no, 3 p.m. is the end of my day. Sorry. Right. You know, but I think, you know what, it can wait till tomorrow. I'm the one putting the pressure on it to get done. So, you know, as long as you can adapt to that a little bit and appreciate it, then it's a great thing. Some people never adapt. I'd say 2 to 5% of people just get too frustrated by the lifestyle. But I have my theory on how it, you know, occurred. Like, to me, anytime you get near the equator, you get that. Like with my background, you know, let's say, you know, I'm a German background or whatever, or let's say you're Norwegian, you got what, 3 or 4 months to produce all the food to survive, you know, for the rest of the year. That created a certain culture. Here, I can go out any day of the year. Doesn't matter whether it's December or August or whatever. I can go catch fish. I can pick up, you know, oranges and apples and bananas or whatever off the trees. I can do whatever I want. I'm not starving. There's no chance of me starving. So I don't really need to plan for the future. I can just, and that goes right through the culture. Like most people don't have a bank account down here. The workers, they deal in whatever I made today will get me through tomorrow. And that's as far forward as I'm thinking. I'm not thinking about retirement ever, right? So you take a ton of stress off when you live like that. You know that, you know, if I decide to retire tomorrow, it's not really going to be a big deal if I'm not earning any cash. It's just, I'm going to go fishing and you know, pick a banana and for my family and I'm good, right? So that, to me, the closer you live, whether it's Latin America or Africa or wherever near the equator, and you have that ability to just no urgency for food production, is the polar opposite of the northern or farther southern climates where you basically, your culture was built on impatience. Right. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, let's start to round this out. So why don't you give sort of a vision for eco villages? I guess I sort of want to like an acute look at, like, you know, you talked about like bringing Bitcoin miners, but I'm also in you, but then you also talked about like more macro, you're going, you know, to Argentina and you're looking at properties in other countries. Is this something you think you're just going to be popping up villages till the day you die, just keep building, or is there sort of an end that you have in mind to what you're working on?
Well, I'm really just trying to do my part, and our company's trying to do its part in creating a place where people can go who, you know, are sick of cancel culture, censorship, and authoritarian governments. Obviously, with my background as a Canadian, what's going on in Canada is pretty brutal right now. Authoritarian governments closing bank accounts, freezing bank accounts, you know, calling out war acts, and, you know, countries, the UK is going through nonsense right now, all over the world. I think in the US you have a bit of a reprieve. I'd take advantage of it, but you're not going to stop the woke culture and authoritarian culture. What's interesting is that a lot of the Western world is going towards socialism, and a lot of the world down here has seen it and seen how it fails, and now is becoming much more capitalist and changing their ways down here. So that's one of the reasons we are creating communities in Latin America. So for me, I'd love to, you know, keep doing this for as long as I can, create communities, you know, all based on this kind of, you know, and it'll again be an evolution. If you talk to me in 10 years, we're probably going to be talking about some other new cool things that we're doing. But realistically, if we could create several dozen, you know, Veritas villages around the region where people could go to always have kind of a freedom oriented place where they know they can say what they want to say. They don't have to worry about talking about, you know, what their, you know, their family or friends are going to call them out on or something, think they're conspiracy theorists or whatever it is. And they can go to different countries and enjoy it and know that they're going to be surrounded by people that, I'm not trying to create this homogenous thing, everybody thinks the same. It's just, you know, we just want to be able to say whatever we want to say.
All right. So my question for you before we got disconnected briefly was, give our, and you've sort of been doing this the whole time, but give our listeners your best pitch. Why should they buy into the Eco Village concept and take action, get a place, you know, in one of these magnificent communities?
Well, I think, you know, it's not necessarily for everybody. We, you know, we have a very kind of libertarian, like-minded group of people that, like, if you don't like authoritarian governments, what's going on in the Western world right now, if you want to have a plan B or your plan A, a place to go where, you know, you'll find like-minded people to sit around with and enjoy, and also, you know, are wanting to have that place. If you're worried about, you know, the economics of countries around the world where you're printing money and in such incredible debt that, you know, you're probably going to end up seeing bank collapses and things like that. If you want to get your money out, you know, obviously Bitcoin is a good place to put it, but even other banks without, you know, in this area, Panama is a banking hub. And, you know, there's just lots of reasons. And, you know, for me, the, you know, high taxes, you can get to the point where you have zero taxes here. On income tax and other very, very small taxes. But you know, there's lots of reasons to want to leave, but then on the other hand, there's lots of reasons to want to be here. It's a beautiful place, a beautiful climate. We, you know, we're trying to create communities that are, you know, kind of, you know, like I saw communities many, many decades ago where it was just a good group of people, you know, living together. I grew up in a farming community where it was like the old adage, if your barn burned down, your neighbors would come by and help you rebuild it. And that was kind of the thing that, you know, we're recreating. It's nice to move out into the wilderness somewhere on your own and try to, you know, kind of be your own homesteader. But this is, you get all the benefits of that you know, this, that kind of sovereignty of your own life, but you have like-minded people around you to kind of have your back. And, you know, and it's a great place to, you know, like I said, with woodworking shops and different types of things, you know, tilapia pond for fishing and all sorts of things, amphitheaters, lots of stuff to do, you know, lots of stuff for kids to do. So, you know, if it resonates with you, I think it's a great place to have, you know, if not where you want to live full time, it certainly is a plan B, and we'd love to have you as neighbors.
Terrific. I think that's a good pitch. Okay. Last question. This is one I ask everyone at the end of the podcast. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold? Bonus points if it offends some Bitcoiners.
Well, I keep telling Bitcoiners to spend their bloody Bitcoin, but stop hodling. But that's just my personal opinion. It's not very popular. I also have an NFT fan, which a lot of Bitcoiners don't like. We actually sold the first titled property down here in Latin America as an NFT. It was amazing. You know, you purchase with Bitcoin on the Liquid sidechain. And yeah, it cost 8 cents in transaction fees to sell a six-figure condominium. And so I it happened like this: the real estate agent got paid, the seller obviously got paid, the guy that did some legal work got paid, and it was all like into their wallet instantly, and everybody was super happy. And the transaction cost 8 cents. So I was a big fan of that, and we've done a couple of those. And but for whatever reason, Bitcoiners typically don't like NFTs because they think of a Viking with a lightning bolt through his head picture or something like that, and that's not what I'm talking. I'm talking about real world uses for NFTs. So. That's all I can think of off the top of my head.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's a good one. Because my knee-jerk reaction is like, oh, NFTs. But I understand that you're not talking about monkey JPEGs.
Or, yeah, exactly.
A lot of the scammy nonsense that's out there. So, well, Patrick, this has been an absolute pleasure. Man, I hope I get to move down there and see you at some point, because this is an amazing, amazing thing that you guys are doing. Love the concept, love the execution. Some of the things that you've shared are just sort of above and beyond what I think most people would expect, even of a community like this. So excellent work. Keep it up. And thank you so much for your time. Why don't you give a quick handoff? Where can people learn more about EcoVillages, find you online, contact you all?
Yeah, you can go to ecovillages.life, not .com, ecovillages.life on the internet. And if you go to the communities page there, you'll see Veritas Villages. And it basically shows our philosophy of what we're doing here and kind of what we talked about today. So that's probably the best place. Or you can send an email to info@ecovillages.life. And I really appreciate being on the show and thanks for having me. And I'm hoping you can come down and at very least visit us, if not become a neighbor sometime. So
I'd love to, Patrick. Thank you so much for your time. Look forward to staying in touch with you and connecting again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot again.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Patrick. Again, this was just unbelievable to me. So eye-opening. I love what they're doing. Go check out EcoVillages if you're looking for a plan B or just a place to go move and get away from the rat race and the hustle and bustle of Western life as we know it. This sounds like an unbelievable option, so make sure you contact them if you want some more information. Of course, if you enjoyed the episode, do me a favor, like and subscribe, share this with someone, leave us a comment. Really appreciate your support. And of course, if you do need a plan B, talk to the Bitcoin Way. We have Plan B residency options in Panama. We would love to help walk you through that process, make it simple for you. We also help with 100% Bitcoin self-custody, online privacy, setting up privacy phones. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast to schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We would love to see you there. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Until next time, Stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.